Welcome to Radio Sefarad's English Corner. I'm your host, Linda Jimenez, bringing news and other features of Jewish interest to Radio Sefarad's English-speaking audience in Spain and around the world. Our trivia question for this week is, how did Wolf first discover that there were individual Jews who resisted Nazi persecution? Wolf Gruner is a German academic who's been the founding director of the Dornsife Center for Advanced Genocide Research at the University of Southern California Shoah Foundation since 2014. He currently holds the Chappelle Guerin Chair in Jewish Studies and is also professor of history at USC. Since 2017, he's been a member of the Academic Advisory Committee of the Center for Advanced Holocaust Studies at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. Gruner is an internationally recognized expert on genocide and has published 10 books and numerous articles on the Holocaust in Europe, as well as on mass violence against indigenous people in Latin America. After more than a decade of research, he recently published his latest book, Resistors: How Ordinary Jews Fought Persecution in Hitler's Germany. Forgotten until now, between 1933 and 1945, many hundreds of Jewish women and men performed individual acts of resistance within Nazi Germany itself. Gruner presents many of their stories in this book on forgotten acts of individual defiance and protest of German and Austrian Jews in Nazi Germany. While the book is well-researched and contains numerous references and notes, it's written in a very interesting non-academic style that will appeal to the general public as well as to scholars.
Thank you very much for speaking with us today, Wolf.
Thanks for having me.
First, could you tell us a little bit about where you were born and grew up and what you studied?
Yeah, so I grew up in East Germany, so behind the Iron Curtain. And I studied history, mainly with the interest to understand the Holocaust and the German Nazi past. And unfortunately, I could not have done my PhD in East Germany because I was distant to the regime. And so some coincidence and luck kind of changed my career path because the wall came down, and this enabled me to pursue a PhD and an academic career. And when I started, and this I already did as a kind of a master's thesis or senior thesis in East Germany as an undergraduate, I focused on Jewish forced labor, first in my diploma thesis and then later in my dissertation. And a kind of Jewish forced labor, which is not so well known, which was organized early on by civil authorities in Germany and Austria, first for unemployed Jews and then for all Jewish men and women in Nazi Germany.
Growing up behind the Iron Curtain and having your education there, how did they view studying about the Nazis? I imagine that it wasn't difficult, no, because the Nazis were their enemies during the war.
Yeah, I think it was a little bit ambivalent. On the one hand, to kind of deal or study the Nazi past was kind of very kind of mainstream because East Germany understood itself as an anti-fascist country, as disrupting continuity after the Second World War ended. And so there was positive positive conditions for studying the Nazi past. However, it was at the same time restricted. Most of the energy went into understanding communist resistance or leftist resistance, and not so much what happened towards the Jews. So the Holocaust was kind of a little bit marginalized in the East German understanding. On the other hand, there was a lot of literature which you could use, publications with documents about the persecution of the Jews in some localities, Jewish literature, quite a lot of memoirs. There were movies done on the persecution of the Jews in East Germany. So it was a very complex situation, I would say.
Because I know people who basically are from your generation who grew up at the same time as you did in West Germany, and they didn't learn anything about the Holocaust at all over there.
Yeah, because after the 1990s, after the reunification, Germany paid more attention to the Holocaust and also the study of the Holocaust. Before that, in West Germany, it was mainly teachers and archivists who kind of tried to investigate the past of their own city usually. And in East Germany, there was, I would say, even less on this level, on the grassroots level. But I said the situation was ambivalent, and I think it's very similar in the West, where also the focus was, while not on communist resistance, but it was on conservative resistance, and the focus was on the kind of the Nazi state, but not so much on the Holocaust.
You've done work relating to the comparative history of mass violence and its resistance on a global scale, as well as racial and state discrimination against indigenous and other minority populations, especially in Latin America. Could you tell us a little bit about that and how you became interested in it?
Yeah, so I became interested in comparative studies because of personal experiences, because I witnessed racism in Latin America, and so I started to think about to study it on the one hand to understand this kind of history of racism in itself, but I also saw some parallels how prejudice were applied to the discriminated groups. And so after writing several books on the Holocaust on different aspects, from starting with the Jewish forced labor, then about the public welfare in Nazi Germany, how they excluded needy Jews, to the initiative role of city governments, then I kind of created this project to see how indigenous people in Bolivia were discriminated against. And I got some funding in Germany. So I lived in Bolivia. And later I published a book on the discrimination against the indigenous majority, in this case, in Bolivia in the 19th century.
How did you become interested in the Holocaust and German Jewish history? You've written almost a dozen books on the topic. Where did your interest come from?
It stems from my personal experiences in East Germany, where I grew up, because I witnessed racism on a kind of almost daily basis among ordinary East Germans, for example, against foreigners and so on. And at the time, I was actually working in a printing shop and had done an apprenticeship, and I was a writer. But this kind of observation of the racism really triggered my interest, and I tried to understand it. I read, started to read, and saw at the time, this was the end of the 1970s and the beginning of the 1980s, the explanations how racism emerges in a society were usually, on the one hand, focused on the Holocaust, and on the second, the explanation was very simplistic, that there is a need for state-sponsored ideology, which is racist. However, this was not applicable in East Germany because the state was actually against racism. The propaganda was everybody is equal, kind of workers of the whole world unite. So there was this contradiction of daily kind of racism on the ground and the state who didn't really promote it. So that's when I decided to study history to really understand the German example of the Holocaust.
Do you think that that racism on the ground was in a way in rebellion against the government policies?
Yes and no. I mean, in the 1980s, there are kind of some neo-Nazism kind of in a way surfaced, which was partly hidden kind of in the through line from families, but also somehow understood at the utmost rebellion against the communist. So to be neo-Nazi was kind of, so to speak, the gold standard of rebellion for some. But I think the people, this is what I try struggle to understand, is really some people, that for them it was not rebellion, it was just habitus, right? It was feeling more powerful to exclude other people. So in this way, it was very a complex situation, which really intrigued me to study this.
You have a special advantage because you're German, and so you could read original documents without a problem without needing a translator. But is it generally difficult for researchers to access these documents? And have you yourself had any problems doing research, or have you run into any resistance from the authorities?
No, actually, not at all. And I had even an extra bonus because when I started my dissertation after the wall came down, I was looked at practically as a kind of an exotic historian because I came from the East, which people in West German archives never encountered. And so I had actually, I was very, in most cases, positively surprised how welcoming the archivists were, how they tried to help me. But a lot of the work in archives is up to the historian and the creativity to find documents. So this was not an issue. There's one exception, and this, or two exceptions. One exception was that when I was working on forced Jewish forced labor, I discovered that a lot of small and big German private enterprises were benefiting from Jewish forced labor within Germany even before the war for road construction and other stuff. And so I tried to get into archives of German companies, and this was where I ran into a wall, especially in the western parts of the country. And the other one was one exception that one city archive denied access to almost all kind of archival holdings. I later learned that this was kind of typical for this archive because the director was blocking. But this is just really the exception of the rule.
Let's talk about this new book. There's a general belief, I think, that the Jews in Germany were passive as the discrimination increased and they just kind of adapted to it, for example, to anti-Jewish legislation. But before getting into details about what you write about in the book, how did you first discover that there were individual acts of resistance? And why do you think it's taken so long for these stories to come to light?
These are two questions. Let me first start with how I encountered this topic. So at the time, I was already investigating the persecution of the Jews in Germany for quite a long time, for a dozen of years. And I thought I would be one of the specialists for Nazi Germany and the persecution of the Jews. And I thought of myself as very well informed. However, when I was in an archive, and this is like long ago in 2008 in Berlin, I studied a source which nobody had looked at before for the study of the persecution of the Jews, which were police diaries of Berlin police precincts. And between hundreds of handwritten entries about stolen bicycles, exhibitionists, drunken people, damaged boardwalks, there was this one entry where it said political offense, and the note was about the arrest of a Jewish man who had protested against the persecution. And as you said, there was this understanding, and there's still this understanding that Jews adapted. So this was surprising as a fact that the Jew in public would speak up and critique the Nazi persecution. So on the one hand, I never had heard about this, and I thought I'm a specialist in this field, in this area, in this field. And then on the other hand, it resonated with me in a way it might have not resonated with others, because from my personal experience in East Germany, I knew that sometimes very minimal acts can be perceived by the regime as a threat. And I thought this is surprising, but also not surprising for me, that Jews actually spoke up and that they were arrested for it. And so I started to investigate more. And immediately, when I dug deeper in police records, but also court materials, I found more and more cases. And first, I studied Berlin, and I thought maybe it is a huge city, or it was a huge city, so it was easier for Jews to speak up or to do other acts of resistance. But then I did studies in Leipzig, Dresden, Hamburg, Munich, and even Vienna, and found in all the cities not only more cases of Jewish women and men speaking up against the persecution over the whole course of the time from the 1930s to the 1940s, but also a huge variety of other acts of resistance. And this is what I lay out in the book, where I tried to kind of bring all this huge variety of individual small deeds, acts of resistance into some organization that I came up with five different categories of individual resistance.
I think that being a native German speaker probably helped you with finding these records that nobody else might have looked at before.
Yeah, first of all, a native speaker, yes, but increasingly we have an international kind of cohort of scholars who work on the Holocaust, and most of them read German, and so they have access to these same sources. It is sometimes about, as I said, coincidence, but also systematic search. So when I started with the idea, from my experience, my previous experience of research, I suspected where I can find similar materials. And so I had worked in German archives for 20 years at this point on different topics. So I was very familiar with the landscape, where I can suspect materials. And so I started digging.
Did you use other kinds of sources besides these documents and police and court records? Did you interview people or?
Yeah, so and this is an important fact. Often before my research, historians had two types of sources when they wanted to study the attitudes and the behavior of the German Jewish population. And on the one hand, these were Nazi reports of Nazi administrations, but also the Gestapo and the SS. And then on the other hand, they used diaries and letters. In both sources, this type of individual resistance, which I investigated, didn't really appear. The Nazis didn't want to kind of portray kind of Jews as resistors. And Jews, when they have written their ego documents, like their diaries or letters, they were often very cautious to write about kind of challenging things because of the fear of inspection and confiscation of their writings. So what I did was actually thinking about finding Jewish attitudes in perpetrator sources. This is which is reflected by the use of these police records and court records. But then I complemented it with survivor testimonies, video testimonies of the USC Shoah Foundation. So I used over 170 interviews where Jews described what they experienced in Germany. However, there was a problem, which was the general problem that the understanding, not only among historians, the public, but also among survivors, was resistance is only organized and has to be armed against the Nazis, and mainly happened, if it happened at all, in Eastern Europe and not in Germany.
I really liked the way the book was organized because you have five chapters and each one deals with a specific type of resistance. And then you describe one case in detail. And after that, you give examples of other people who resisted in a similar way, but in a very short description of what they each did. I was wondering if you could briefly tell us what those five types of resistance were and give us one of the short examples of each, not going into the detail of the long one.
Yeah, so first of all, I tried to kind of write each chapter as one main story because I wanted to also not only highlight the acts of resistance itself, but also the people who actually committed the resistance. And so, since I had such a huge variety of cases, I organized this under five categories. One was challenging anti-Jewish propaganda and Nazi propaganda. The second was oral protest. The third, written protest. Then disobedience to laws and local regulations was the fourth. And physical self-defense, the most surprising of individuals, was the fifth. So when we think about the category contesting Nazi propaganda, we have to think about cases like ripping down Nazi flags, destroying kind of a besmearing displays of anti-Jewish newspapers. And in the book, the main story is of a man who tried to destroy the swastika logo on a public bus. The next category is oral protest. And I found countless of cases after the first case from the police diary, where Jewish women, young and old Jewish men, protested in public either specifically against certain laws and regulations or in general against the persecution. They often got denunciated and then ended up in jail. And the story in the book is about a woman who went into a shop after Kristallnacht and insulted Hitler and kind of challenged the Nazi propaganda slogan that the pogrom, the Kristallnacht, was just an kind of a result of the outrage of the German people. She kind of insisted that this was organized by the government, and Hitler, whom she called the biggest bandit, was behind everything. And then written protest, we ranged from petitions to anonymous leaflets, also kind of across the 1930s and 40s. And examples I found for several cities, and the story in the book is about 71-year-old man who, after the introduction of the Yellow Star, decides to do something, and he wrote anonymous postcards insulting Hitler and calling him a mass murderer. And on one postcard, he wrote "murderer of 5 million," which was very at the time prophetic. And then stories of disobedience, the fourth category, are in abundance. And in the book, I highlight the story of a 17-year-old adolescent in Frankfurt who, during the war, set off wrong fire alarms at night to divert the firefighters from the actual bombing sites after the air raids by the British Air Force. And the last category, physical self-defense, was the most surprising to me, as I already mentioned, because not only Jewish men got into brawls with stormtroopers, or they beat up Nazi neighbors who harassed kind of Jewish tenants, but also Jewish teenagers defended themselves from classmates who harassed them, members of the Hitler Youth, or neighboring kids. And here I want to highlight that among most of these cases stem actually from the testimonies of the Shoah Foundation. And among the 30 cases in these interviews, which I found of teenagers defending themselves, 11 were from women. So women, girls defended themselves too. And the main story in this chapter is also about a young girl, which was 16 years old and was defending herself against a stormtrooper who wanted to beat her up during a Kristallnacht raid in her retraining camp in Western Germany.
How did you decide which stories to tell in detail and which ones just to include briefly as others?
This has a very practical reason. It took 12 years to do the research for the whole book. And I would say almost half of the time I spent trying to find additional details about people, which I found mentioning in court records. Often I had only limited kind of evidence, for example, a verdict from a court. So I tried to kind of find more biographical data. This was really difficult. So on the one hand, I chose the story which was especially representative for a category, especially highlighting, but sometimes I was limited that I couldn't find the biographical information to tell really a story about this person. The next kind of reason how I kind of composed these five stories was that I want to highlight the role of women, that I want to highlight different age groups. So there's a set of reasonings why I chose these people.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you something about the protest in writing because you said in the book that people were often punished for writing things in letters that they weren't punished for if they wrote the same thing as a petition. And I was wondering if you think that that might have happened because the authorities thought that letters might be read by either normal citizens who didn't know what was going on, or they might go abroad and people might find out about what was happening in Germany and the situation would be publicized, while petitions stayed in the government offices and probably got hidden away someplace. Do you think that that was why?
Yeah, that's actually a very good reason. I think that The most what the Nazis feared was that would be more people paying attention to the persecution of the Jews or even demonstrating solidarity. And so I think you are right. On the one hand, they didn't want to get out kind of complaints, critique, and detailed information about the persecution. But then on the other hand, also petitions were the only outlet which was legally allowed for Jews because they were denied all kind of civil rights and any political participation, but the German constitution allowed petitions as kind of a means to kind of complain about circumstances or conditions. And so Jews widely used this possibility, but on their risk, on their own risk. On the one hand, they had a legal right, but then on the other hand, if they issued critique, they also signed with their names these petitions. But I found them so interesting. We often discarded them as written in vain, but these petitions not only criticized the persecution, either specific laws or the persecution in general, but they also, in a way, the individual authors reclaimed their identities as German citizens in these petitions. They showed them, portrayed themselves as contributors to the fatherland, for example, as front veterans, or they highlighted their financial or cultural contributions to Germany, their homeland, in these petitions.
The book mentions almost in passing that there were non-Jewish Germans and sometimes even policemen who helped Jews to escape either from Germany or from being persecuted or prosecuted for rebellious actions. Can you comment a little bit about that?
So I think in a way it is really interesting. I focus very much on Jewish resistance and especially to highlight individual resistance. So non-organized, what people did often very much on their own. However, they always encountered also people who either kind of just witnessed what they did and did not denunciate them, or sometimes also showed solidarities. And interesting is in the same records which I used, like police records and court records in these different German cities, I always found also German non-Jews, like non-Jewish Germans, who actually surprisingly spoke up in solidarity with Jews or against directly against the Nazi government and the persecution of the Jews and anti-Jewish laws. So there's a whole story still to tell about a lot of non-Jewish Germans who also ended up being arrested and tried and then put in jail for critical comments against the persecution of the Jews in Nazi Germany.
Is there anything else you'd like to add that we might have left out?
Yeah, so what I want to highlight as a kind of essence of the book are two things. One is these individual acts, when we look at individual deeds, it opens up a very new, broader perspective of resistance against the Nazis. And the book and the research for it shows that, kind of against what people usually think, there was no pattern which showed who is more capable of resistance than others. Usually we think these kind of resistors needed special kind of character traits or special upbringing. But my book shows that young and old, men and women, highly educated and blue-collar workers equally committed similar acts of resistance. So that it's fair to say that it shows that when Jews and almost every Jew are from very different kind of corners and social strata can resist, that means that practically everybody is able to resist. So there are no kind of limitations in this regard. I think this is a really important result of the book.
Well, thank you very much.
No, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, that's it for this week. As always, we'd love to hear from you. So please email us any comments or suggestions or questions you'd like us to answer on the air. Our address is English Corner at RadioSefarad.com. See you next week.